Why are you whispering?
I don't know. We did a soft one last time. Mm-hmm. Wait, two times ago. That
well,
was
then
fun.
We should do a hard one this time.
Hello.
Hello.
Did I enunciate that correctly?
I don't know. if only we could do it kind of like Benedict Cumberbatch or some of the other British people who are trying to do an American accent where you do the really hard R. Doctor Strange.
It's good, but there's no R's in hello.
No.
As far as I'm aware, at least.
You can't spell hello without R. But,
can't spell Blues Brothers without an R. That's true.
Yes. Yeah. This movie. I've never seen it. And, as we've established, there is a cultural blind spot for me when it comes to 1970s and early 80s zany comedies.
Cultural blind spot.
Yeah.
I mean, you might be able to just narrow that down to John Landis specifically, but...
I guess that's true, but I think it's a little broader. Like when we did, was it Top Shot or whatever, the Val Kilmer one? Spy Hard or... What am I thinking of?
That movie. What's that movie called?
I don't know. but we did it.
Todd likes it. I think it's stupid. What's that movie called?
I told you I don't know, so why are you asking me?
I'm asking rhetorically to the cloud.
Oh, well, let us all put our ear to the cloud, and we'll hear the sound of seashells. But...
Is that how that works? When one sound goes one way, one goes the other way?
Yeah. So what? But it makes perfect sense when you think about it, because you need the shell to give you the internet. So that makes sense.
You're doing like a terminal thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh, but nobody uses the C shell. You would use like Bash or
you use the C shell on Windows. C:\shell.
No, but that's a PowerShell or whatever. If you're on Windows, you don't want to use that one. It doesn't matter. We're not IT administrators. But
speak for yourself. Maybe I am. You don't know.
Perhaps. And maybe you're running the IT system that helps police officers look up plates on vehicles. But
SCMODs.
That would really roll off the tongue. but this is, like I said, this is a cultural blind spot for me. I've never seen this movie, and I've never felt compelled to see it. And it's not out of... hatred or dislike of blues or jazz or just
or
like,
brothers
or brothers is a complicated subject, but this never spoke to me. And it was on TV a lot, and they even had a very publicized sequel where it was very publicized that it was worse than the first one. It never was the thing that I sought out. And last week, the week before, a listener of the show, incomparable member and subscriber, Rye Amadon, had selected a GIF to share with us from it. And I had to say that I had not seen it. And he was upset. And then sent a tweet that pointed us to our show so that we could find it.
Yes. And meanwhile, on the other end of the spectrum, I didn't need to rewatch this movie because I know all of the words and the songs and all of it, because it was always on TV. In addition to the fact that whenever it was on TV when I was a child, my dad would put it on, and then he would do that thing that dads do, and he would elbow me and repeat the funny line and then point at the TV and say, huh? So now I do that to my wife. Because that's what I do. And just a moment ago, we're coming in here for the show, and she's trying to catch up on some Game of Thrones, and I start walking back into the kitchen going da 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 da, and she goes, "Would you stop it, please?" I'm like, "Well, I can't just walk around doing Blues Brothers interstitial music whenever I feel like it. That's you know." Anyway, I love this movie. I know it very well. I enjoy it. I'm happy to say I made it all the way through watching it, and I did not have any, John Landis PTSD that I was worried about, like we did with Animal House and things like that. So I think we made it mostly unscathed through a John Landis movie without it being horrifyingly problematic.
Well,
It has some mild sexism, and it suffers from being a 1980 movie, but it's not Animal House.
It is not Animal House. It could be a little better, though, about some things. Because I always thought it was weird that Dan Aykroyd and Belushi are the stars of this, singing the blues, and they basically, like, pull in actual singers with talent every now and then to sort of reaffirm that these two white guys are doing a good job in what they're doing in the film.
Well, yeah, that's, you know, those are their heroes and they modeled all of this after them. But it's that's not really something that could be retrofitted necessarily, because this was an SNL skit that then became a movie, as some of them did.
And this is the first SNL skit to movie transition that occurred.
Was it the first?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. It's a weird one, too, because it was like a musical skit thing. It's not like they turned Belushi's mumbling samurai thing into a movie.
Yeah. I'm not sure there are a lot of early skits of Saturday Night Live I would want to see turned into a movie.
You wouldn't want to watch a movie of Eddie Murphy as Gumby or whatever?
Not so much, but...
I am Gumby, damn it.
But this is but he wasn't even early SNL. He was 80s SNL. But this is, man, I don't know. It's just, there's something really odd about a John Landis movie when it comes to how it's structured and put together. And by that, I mean, it seems like all of the film reels fell on the floor and then people just sort of pasted them back together again.
Well, I mean, when you read some of the behind-the-scenes stuff about how Aykroyd turned into a 325-page script or whatever, and Landis had to cut it down, and I think basically they were continuing to rewrite and cut down the entire time they were shooting, you can kind of see how that is just what ends up on screen. But this is not a movie that is heavy on plot. It's a musical, essentially, so it's just kind of like going from scene to scene and performance to performance, and there's a little, like, a thin veil of a story there and some characters that are kind of fun to watch.
A veil of a story? The story's hiding?
yeah, it's hiding behind the habit. You know, gotta get the money for the orphanage.
Yeah, well, I would say thin thread instead of the veil, but, you know.
Sure, threads, veils, whatever, it's all cloth.
Yeah. But this... The thin plot that strings this together is just that they're from an orphanage and that they want to keep the orphanage going, but there's tax money that needs to be paid to an assessor. And you might be like, well, I bet that's the really boring part. But that somehow turns into a calamity at the end. But
it's funny that when we were watching this, my wife was like, how much longer is left in the movie? Are we going to make dinner soon? And I was like, yeah, I think it's pretty much just the car chase that's left. And I hit the clicker and there's 30 minutes left. And I was like, oh, I guess the ending is a little bit longer than I thought. So there's 30 minutes of driving and crashing and driving and crashing and then running through a building and then SWAT guys and army guys and Steven Spielberg.
It is a mess. It's something like, was it 500 extras were used for filming the blockade and storming of the Daily Center stuff. And it's just, yeah, like, this is just absolutely,
it's absurd.
Yeah, I mean, because it's supposed to be funny because it's out of scale with what's actually happening, but
yeah, it's almost like comedy by like attrition or something. They're trying to wear you down with the sheer magnitude of the nonsense.
Yeah, but this is very I don't know, it gets a little like it's pretty Looney Tunes-y sometimes. Like
it's like it's National Lampoon and Landis, like it's all the same sort of stuff. You just take out all of the like childish gross humor that was in Animal House.
Yeah, but like we still have like when the Nazis, which if you had asked me if I thought there would be Nazis in this movie prior to watching this, I would have said no. But
I shouldn't have tweeted that and spoiled it for you that there are the Illinois Nazi subplot there. It is rather unusual that it's there. It must just be because they all thought it was so funny that they didn't feel the need to cut it amongst all of the other things that they cut out of the movie, because they just thought it would be just weird enough and funny enough to keep in there.
Yeah. But going back to the silliness aspect of it, specifically the part where they're driving and doing the chase, and the car with the orange red car with a Gibson in it, the leader guy, mm-hmm. When that
station
goes
wagons.
Yeah. When that goes over, it starts falling, but it's falling towards like a little strip of land with like a couple cars on it. But then it cuts out to like a really wide shot where it's obviously been like dropped from a helicopter.
Yeah, I mean, and don't forget you're led up into the scene by them driving towards an unfinished freeway, and then the Blues Brothers drive backwards and hit the brake fast enough that their car does a backflip over top of the mm-hmm. other car. And then they go flying off Wile E. Coyote style, and then cut to just, you know, they drop the shell of a car from a helicopter over something that was safe, and then filmed that, and then cut back to the fake Hollywood street or whatever. But it's part of that where the movie's just going like, don't worry about this. This is silly. It doesn't make a difference. It's not supposed to be real. In the same way that, you know, like in the performance with Cab Calloway, like the curtain opens and they're all suddenly wearing like white tuxes with tails, and then they go back to their regular clothes inexplicably, like in a cut, and then somehow as Jake and Elwood walk out onto the stage, the stage has grown that like middle section that goes out into the middle of the audience for them to dance on. It's all just part of the spectacle, and it has absolutely nothing to do with continuity whatsoever.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would ever watch a John Landis movie and be like, "Oh no, continuity error," because you would be very tired.
You just watch all movies with John Landis made and going, "Oh, John Landis," just shaking your head subtly.
But the whole thing starts with the Belushi getting out of prison, we get Frank Oz on screen as the guy who's giving him his stuff back before he walks out into the real world. And for some reason, there is a used prophylactic, soiled prophylactic, I believe is what he says. And
one unused, one soiled.
Yeah, and he holds it up with a pencil so that it can be really stiff and raisin-like dangling on either side of the pencil as he looks disapprovingly at Belushi.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's been, what, like 4 years?
Yeah, I mean, why wouldn't they have kept that? But they have him leave.
I love how he gets yanked back from the counter because he has to stand behind the yellow line, and then he leans forward to the counter with his feet still behind the yellow line to sign his X in the form. Mm-hmm. If you don't find joy in these little tiny things, the rest of the movie isn't going to work at all for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's just... You ever heard the expression spark joy?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's not...
Does this movie not Marie Kondo for you?
No. No. I mean, this is not something I own or anything. I streamed it for free, which is why it was on a list of things we could potentially review. This is not connecting with me. There are humorous moments and good musical performances in here. But,
don't worry, a couple dozen more viewings and you're going to love it, I promise.
Yeah, I'm not sure I have it in me. that Comedy Central time has passed. But the opening, we get him going out the side of the prison. There's the car parked there with Dan Aykroyd in it, and Belushi's silhouetted by very brightly lit whatever it was behind him.
A 20 by 20 grip silk with a big light behind it.
So silly. But they meet, and then Belushi's all upset about the Cadillac. As we've established, Cadillacs are incredibly important to some people. Dan Aykroyd says that he sold it because he needed a microphone. This establishes some of the money problems that they have, and they got to go see the Penguin. And this is where you start to realize that Dan Aykroyd is going to do that accent for the whole movie, and there's nothing you can do about it.
You know,
do you think Dan Aykroyd would say challenge, just out of curiosity?
He didn't say Chicago.
No.
I think the dispatch guy on the radio for the police was the closest guy to say Chicago. No. Dan Aykroyd's accent is very silly. What's funny is later on in life, in the sequel and in other places, when he tries to do that accent again, he's kind of parodying his character, and it's even less believable and enjoyable to listen to than in this movie.
Oh, wow. I'm really looking forward to next week.
Oh, God. Are we going to have to do it?
I mean,
is that how this
we?
Goes? Like, we watch a movie that's near and dear to my heart, and then we ruin it the week after by watching the awful sequel to it?
Yeah, I mean, because otherwise it wouldn't make any sense why we would watch the sequel. We gotta
it doesn't make any sense to watch
you.
The sequel in any context at all, because it's
terrible. You've already seen it.
I've seen it once, maybe twice. It is very bad. It definitely does not run on television as often as the Blues Brothers.
Yes,
does.
It is also not free on Amazon, so that's another thing.
Yeah, they're still trying to recoup the production cost of that one.
Yeah, whoopsie daisy.
When one of your main actors is a 10-year-old child dressed like one of the Blues Brothers.
Mm. Well,
oh, Frank Oz is still in it again. Look at that.
It's hard to believe that they would have issues with meeting the budget and not going over and not running over their schedule, etc. Because this one went so smoothly, according to Wikipedia.
There's also, I didn't get a chance to reread the entire thing before the show tonight, but I read it, I don't know, whenever, a couple years ago. There's a really good, very in-depth Vanity Fair article about the production and all of these stories that you read briefly about on Wikipedia.
Yeah. Oh, so there's more details about Carrie Fisher having to babysit.
The mountains of cocaine. Yeah, all of that stuff. The club that they owned then spent all of their time at when they weren't on set, just like not sleeping. And then sleeping randomly in the middle of the day.
Yeah, because Belushi would miss his call times and stuff. Go figure.
I mean, the inflation number is kind of hilarious when you see the budget on this. They spent like $27 million or something, and that's like the equivalent of like an $83 million movie, which is insane to think that they would spend that much money on a movie of this magnitude, which is to say very small in scope, but...
Well, I mean, inflation is hilarious when you're watching that scene in the fancy French restaurant when they start quoting prices.
The soup's $10. Like, what's wrong with $10 soup, man?
And the Dom Perignon is $120.
Oh, my God. Can you even imagine spending $125 on a bottle of Dom Perignon?
And it wasn't just a year or non-vintage or anything. It was 1971. It was a 9-year-old bottle of Dom Perignon by when this movie's supposed to be taking place. But at least Pee Wee Herman got a little job. There's a Paul Rubens there as a waiter for 5 seconds.
I mean, everybody's got to, you know, pay the bills and stuff.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of little tiny cameos in here.
Was anything particularly surprising?
Twiggy. I think that was the biggest surprise.
Was Spielberg spoiled for you?
No, actually, and I think I looked away and missed it. I had read ahead of time that Spielberg would be in here, and then I kept waiting for him, and then I didn't see him, so I think I, like, blinked or something. But
He's in there for, like, a solid minute or two. He's just chewing on a sandwich, and he's got his big glasses. Mm. This is back before he had an axe to grind against streaming services, so he's just, you know, low-key Spielberg.
Low-key Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
Just
hanging out.
Yeah, you're John Candy. He's got like a beefier role in this than most of the others who show up.
John Candy is good, yes.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't think of a bad John Candy appearance. Can you?
No. Mm-hmm. Wait, what am I thinking of?
I don't know.
It's not Uncle Buck. I haven't seen Uncle Buck in a really long time. I shouldn't judge that.
I like Uncle Buck, but I haven't seen it in a long time too, so maybe I don't.
I'm thinking of you remember the really terrible movie Dutch?
Oh,
with what's his name?
Yeah, no, but that's not John Candy. That's
No, I know, but I feel like there's a movie where John Candy plays a character similar to that, and I think I might be conflating Uncle Buck and something else.
Yes, you might be conflating Uncle Buck and Dutch because he's looking after a kid in that, and there's a kid being looked after.
Yeah, but I'm thinking of something where he plays like a jerky sort of friend or uncle or something.
Well, he's a jerk in Uncle Buck.
Maybe in a different capacity than I'm imagining.
Okay, maybe. This is fun to dwell on. But did you ever see that one where John Candy was a writer who got trapped in his own soap opera thing?
You sure you're not talking about that Will Ferrell movie?
No. It was a John Candy movie. I can't believe I'm going to be Dan and I'm going to start looking up stuff on the show.
Is it Spaceballs?
No, it wasn't Spaceballs. What are you talking about?
Planes, Trains, and Automobiles?
Yes, Dan, it was that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Armed and Dangerous.
Silly. Wow. It was Delirious.
Delirious. Yeah. That's not just the Eddie Murphy one, huh?
No,
I don't know if I've seen this.
Delirious is a 1991 fantasy comedy starring John Candy, Mariel Hemingway, Emma Sams, Raymond Burr, David Rash, I don't know, Dylan Baker, and Charles Rocket. The film used Prince's 1982 song as its title theme.
Huh. Yeah. Some of these frames look familiar.
It was on TV all the time.
Hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm.
Jerry Orbach is in it.
You know, I do have some personal affection for these really like cheesy, like barely held together with tape kinds of movies from the 80s and early 90s.
So you like Canadian Bacon?
Another one I haven't seen in a very long time. You know, I honestly, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, I don't love that movie, partly because just like, you know, anytime you put an actor in a situation where it's like, oh, look how terrible everything is for this person and their life is so miserable and they can't seem to get out of the misery. It's like, I don't find that enjoyable to watch, even if it is Steve Martin and John Candy.
Well, you like Blues Brothers. They're people who are miserable, who are trying to get out of their
They're
misery.
Not really miserable. Like,
well, they don't see...
This is their life. Like, I think Elwood is frankly like... enjoys the fact that, you know, even though he lives in that terrible little apartment, like, he has a place to call home where he can listen to records and make his little toast on his hot plate with a bent hanger and just, you know, hang out and have his own place. Like, I think he feels like home in that environment.
That's disturbing.
I mean, this is what it's like living on the tough streets of Chicago. Chicago is not a glamorous place.
Yeah, he's got an elevated train.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It goes by so often you won't even notice. You sleaze my bed.
But
you just quote, I'm gonna quote the whole movie to you.
You could do that.
Did you get my cheese, boy? I love that guy. It completely just out of nowhere. I would love to know if there's a scene that was cut from this that explained that, but also I don't want to know that just he had to go pick up a can of Cheese Whiz for somebody while he was out in the town.
I guess. I mean, his Cheese Whiz, it's shelf stable. He could have been carrying that around for a while.
I mean, especially because, yeah, he had to go pick up Jake early in the day. He's at least had it probably since the night before.
Possibly. But they arrive at his abode and they... We should do the setup of the orphanage thing. So they go see the penguin, as they keep saying over and over again, because I guess it gets funnier if they say it more often. But they park the car.
It's funnier when you say it in the accent. Okay. You got to go visit the penguin. I can't even do his
that
thing.
Wasn't an accent. But they go up the stairs. It's shut Dutch with the cross hanging there. Mm-hmm. And
the very bloody Jesus.
Yes, very bloody Jesus. And they enter, and they are instructed to sit in the little like student desk things in front of her big desk. and she says how terrible everything is because the tax went up and they can't pay the tax and the church won't pay it because they don't really care about keeping the place open. So she's sad that the like public school or something is going to take it over. And
Board of Education.
Board of Education.
That's supposed to mean.
Yeah. I don't know. Godless secular people are going to take over the orphanage.
I mean, you know, they're doing the Lord's work and taking in the orphan children.
Yeah.
Who are frankly very adorable at the end there when they're handing out all of the flyers and stuff.
Yeah. They do that. But she she raps on their knuckles with the ruler because they start cursing and taking the Lord's name in vain, etc. And then she yells at them. She's disappointed and they leave. And she doesn't want their dirty money if they were to steal it. So she won't accept it. They go downstairs and meet Curtis, the janitor who they had befriended many years ago. And
help raise him.
Yeah. And that's Cab Calloway. And they're telling him the sob story and he's telling them the sob story about the thing in like 11 days or whatever it is. And then he says, oh, but you know, the nun was right. You guys, you need Jesus. So go to church. And he sends them to a church with a preacher. This is obviously not a Catholic church, where they're going through a whole big service and musical number and everything. Mm-hmm. And
Reverend Cleophas James, played by James Brown.
He sure is. And
he's very sweaty. He's got the hair. He's got the robe.
I mean, he was doing a lot of dancing and singing and stuff. So probably warm you up pretty well inside of that space with all those other people. But then the
my favorite part about the musical number is the people on the trampolines. Those angles that are shooting up at the stained glass on the walls, and they're just people doing backflips like 30 feet up in the air.
It's a little silly. But then the sunlight comes in, and the light shines down on Belushi, and he gets a blue blob drawn on him.
He becomes a Jedi ghost.
Yeah, and Jim Belushi's Jedi ghost decide.
John, oh my god.
I can't tell that Belushi's apart.
You, oh my god, you take that back right now.
Which one was on the CBS show? Was that Jim?
Jim is the bad one. Who does all of the bad movies and things.
Okay. I'm going to say that's kind of hard for me to remember that distinction.
What CBS show?
Wasn't there... Oh, I guess the way I can remember it is I think it's called According to Jim. That would be a good way for me to remember that was Jim Belushi.
Yeah, he was on a show called According to Jim, a show called K-9 and Curly Sue.
Okay, well, I think the According to Jim one is probably the best way for me to remember his name is Jim.
He also played the... what was he? The monkey in Trading Places?
Oh, that's... delightful thing. Good for him.
Was he the monkey? Or what else was he dressed up as? I forget. Yeah, it doesn't matter.
Well, there was the ape in the cage, because the other Belushi was the
Yeah. I thought they stole his costume and put it on the bad guy.
Yeah, but I thought that was John Belushi.
No,
that was Jim Belushi?
That was Jim, yeah.
Okay. See, it gets back to the whole thing and you can't tell them apart.
You can look at them and tell them apart.
I guess.
Okay,
but they
he sees the light. Yeah, they got to put the band back together because they were one of the greatest rhythm and blues bands of all time, the Blues Brothers, and they're going to play a big show and get a bunch of money and save the orphanage for the Penguin.
And to do that, they have to go collect everyone. They are unable to locate the first people that they go to seek, but she has a card. And it's for a Holiday Inn, I believe, where the guys have their own little like lousy lounge band that they have going on, where they're collecting money doing that as a regular gig. Belushi and Aykroyd talk them into joining the band because you know, what they're doing right now isn't that fulfilling, et cetera. And
Murph and the Magic Towns. Yeah, well, again, you glossed over one of the lines that I always love is the, are you the police? No, ma'am, we're musicians. It's another one of the many classic lines.
Dan?
Uh-huh?
I need you to do something for me.
Not quote every line
no,
at you?
No. But if you want to quote the line readings,
uh-huh,
then you got to walk through the summary.
Okay, I can do it. I can do it.
Okay, you sure? Are you prepared to summarize this movie you may have seen 20-something times?
The difficulty is once I've seen it that many times, it feels more like I'm defending a movie to you rather than like we both saw a movie.
I don't have my gavel, so just imagine a gavel.
It'd probably be better if you just stopped me at places that didn't work or were no, because that doesn't work, because it's a John Landis movie. None of it works.
Believe me, I'm capable of interrupting you. Proceed.
No, I mean, you know.
Proceed, counsel.
Along this way, I have questions about the music, like, because the whole thing is cued to music, and is any of that creating a mood that is enjoyable for you along the way? They're playing it in the car. I mean, aside from the fact that once they get to the Holiday Inn, Murph and the Magic Tones are playing the terrible Spanish song, whatever the hell it may have been called.
I mean, other than that, I find the music enjoyable and the songs that were selected.
Are they songs that you have heard before or were familiar with?
Both.
Mm. Mm. Okay, that's good. That's helpful.
I mean, a lot of them are classics. Like the 60s classics and stuff that you would have already heard. The thing I couldn't believe was when I was reading the Wikipedia page and it's like they wanted 70s disco stuff or whatever that they had access to at the moment. And that was shut down.
Oh, I missed that on the Wikipedia page. When was that supposed to have taken place?
I don't remember. I think it was something that Wasserman or Universal, some other Universal exec had said. Just to save on money.
Oh, for licensing rights purposes? Yeah.
Yeah, because like having Aretha Franklin in the like the singers that they wanted to give roles to had not had major success in a long time. So they didn't really see the reason to incorporate them.
They wanted to do some corporate tie-ins maybe?
Yeah, they just wanted something that they thought would be more bankable.
Hmm. They wanted Tony Stark to show up and, you know, sing a duet or something with them.
Sure.
Yeah. But yeah, you got the fellas at the Holiday Inn. Mr. Fabulous is a maitre d' at Shea Paul, where you got the fun scene where they go to the restaurant and they are absolutely horrible and disgusting to everyone. And I like that one of the regular people in the restaurant comments on the fact that they are loud, offensive, and smelly because you know it's one of the things in the movie where you're like, they don't ever change their clothes or seem to clean themselves or anything, and they have a shared bathroom in this terrible apartment. That seems like they're a little gross, and then one of the characters is like, yeah, these guys are kind of gross. And I particularly love later in the movie where they go to the sauna and they're wearing their hat and glasses. They basically may as well have shot that scene with them in their suits, sweating through it and all of that. But anyway, they behave like pigs. They order 5 shrimp cocktails and some bottles of champagne and throw food into each other's mouths. And John Belushi tries to buy the man's children in a very weird voice.
The daughter and the wife.
Yes. How much for your women? I want to buy your women.
Yeah. I think this might be one of the funnier scenes in the movie for me is this thing where they're trying to provoke their former friend by being unbearable in this restaurant.
Yeah, we're going to come here for breakfast, lunch, and dinner if you don't join the band, because he's got a high-paying job. He's not down on his luck after the Blues Brothers had split, so it's a little harder to get him out of there.
Yeah. So they try. They go for it.
Wrong glass, sir. And then, you know, just does that little face, and he shakes his water goblet at the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah, he reluctantly agrees to join the band, and that angry man continues to yell sir at the maitre d' as we fade out. It's really weird to watch this movie, honestly, without it being on TV and commercials, because there's a lot of just like fade to black, fade up somewhere else, and it's like there's where the commercial break goes.
Well, there's something very peculiar about that, because it happens like what was it? In the car chase, when it's nighttime, they do a cut where the music even fades when they're fading to black and then fade up and then the music fades up again. And it's just
talking about when the cops pull them over?
No. At the when it's nighttime and then the next shot is the Chicago skyline in early morning.
Oh yeah.
There's a fade to black with the music fade and then a fade up with the music fading up, and it's just like what why did you do that? Like, did you need to change your reel? Like, that was a weird thing that happened.
Oh, that's actually a very interesting point, because this is filmy stuff. I wonder how many of those fade ups and downs there were. I feel like there's like four, so maybe it was for reel changes. That would be really weird though.
Really weird. I don't think it would be that weird. It's just it seems clumsy in execution. I have to feel like there would be better places you could hide those reel changes.
It does seem suspiciously amateur compared to the rest of the movie, which they put a fair amount of effort into, despite its shortcomings.
Yeah, I mean, John Landis is if not a polished professional.
When was the last time he made a movie? Actually, don't tell me. I don't want to know, because it was probably horrible.
I don't know. The last thing I remember seeing him in is when he's walking around with Terry Gilliam in that London thing in the middle of
the
night.
That movie's finally coming out now.
The Terry Gilliam thing?
Yeah.
Mm. Interesting.
I'm not sure people are particularly stoked. He did an episode of Franklin and Bash in 2012.
It's a weird choice. Is that for to maintain his SAG qualification? I mean, DAG qualifications or something?
I don't know. And there's this movie in 2010 with Simon Pegg, Andy Serkis,
Burke and Hare,
Ella Fisher. Yeah, what is this?
I have never heard of this.
Yeah, me neither. This went by without a mention. Huh. Okay. Anyway, John Landis. What I mean. His career is about as weird as his personality.
And I've heard some unsavory things about his character. So,
right. Some of that stuff has been more recent, recently forthcoming, hasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I hear things. Sources familiar with the matter.
Yeah. Allegedly, reportedly, kind of a weirdo, and maybe not great. Anyway.
Yeah. Also, his son, also not good.
Let's not.
We should veer into that. I mean, how much you want to bet if John Landis were to die that Max Landis would reboot the Blues Brothers with Seth Rogen and who else?
Would they do what's his name that was in all of the other movies?
Jonah.
No. The other one, Evan Goldberg, the creepy guy from the interview.
James Franco,
yes.
The other
Franco
guy.
And Rogan. It sounds like a Max Landis reboot of Blues Brothers. God, please don't ever let that happen. Unless he decided to take it into a different genre and have it be like techno DJs or something.
How would that make it better?
It wouldn't make it better. It would make it more. It would make it more distinct and further away from Blues Brothers. So I feel like it would damage the Blues Brothers franchise less.
Okay.
Because it's already on thin ice with its one sequel.
All right. Well, let's not ruin the classics. But
yeah. Anyway, at this point is when we meet our Illinois Nazis on our way from recruiting the band to see a bunch of Nazis marching on a bridge, and the city of Chicago foaming at the mouth to try and beat them up and throw them into the river.
Yeah. And the one cop guy, they flag down, and they're like, what's going on? And he's like, bleeping Nazis. And so then they go drive around the cars they're waiting behind, and then they gun it. And all the Nazis jump off the bridge and into the water.
They were standing their ground right up until the moment that they heard the engine rev real high, like they were gunning it at them, and they all dive into the water.
Yeah, and then...
Which, to be honest, that's what we would all like to do to Nazis.
Yeah. Oh, and then Gibson, the leader guy, tells the other guy to get the plate, and then we'll have one of their guys run it, which is why we keep seeing them for the rest of the film. I feel like this like you had said earlier, I feel like this whole thread could be removed from this movie because it doesn't seem to go anywhere.
It's kind of funny that you have like multiple groups of people chasing them at the end of the movie. You got the cops, you got the good old boys slash Bob, and then you got the Nazis all chasing them for different reasons from different directions. But like, you probably could have gotten away with just like the good old boys and the cops and not the Nazis. But they're there to make it just all the more slapstick as they're speeding around.
Yeah. There is, of course, that one shot of him painting his ceramic hawk or whatever, which is mildly entertaining. But
his Maltese Falcon.
Okay. But they do this, and they accrue another enemy in addition to the police and in addition to Carrie Fisher's rocket launcher.
And we glossed over the fact that when they first got to Elwood's place, she shoots a 3-barreled bazooka at them and blows up the front entryway of the building, to which they sort of just dust themselves off and like try to go inside, and the doors just fall off.
Mm-hmm. And then when the building explodes the next morning, they dust themselves off from the bricks and rubble.
I love the brick sounds, because they're all exactly the same sound effect. And just like, it's so beyond cheesy, and you can see that all of the bricks are made out of foam. It makes me laugh so much.
The sound library in this was pretty limited.
I feel like at least half of it's on purpose, because they do the same thing with the machine gun, and the sound of the bricks that collapsed on them is also the same sound of the like pebbles from the bazooka that they like brush off their shoulders as they're walking up the stairs. It makes me laugh. I can't help it.
Okay.
And just the ridiculousness of the, you know, shooting the rocket launcher, and then later when you see her like doing her nails and leafing through the flamethrower user guide.
Apology accepted.
What?
Apology accepted. You said I can't help it.
So. I don't apologize. I take it back.
All right, counsel. Return to your story.
Oh my God. So then, this is when we go to find Mad Guitar Murphy and Lulu, working with Aretha Franklin, and we discover their lunch proclivities, dry white toast and 4 fried chickens and a Coke.
Yes, and she says wings were, what did you say, wings or thighs? Or
thighs, something like that.
Yeah, and he says 4 fried chickens.
4 whole fried chickens.
Yeah.
Can you even fry a chicken whole? It seems unwise.
Oh, yeah, you would not want to do that, because by the time the interior of the chicken was cooked, the exterior of it would be disgusting. It'd be rock hard.
Although, compared to prison food, it's probably not terrible. Although, for some reason, this movie makes multiple references to pepper steak. I'm not sure if that's a Chicago thing or a thing that Belushi was particularly into, but yeah, it's in there twice.
Mm. Double the pepper steak, double your fun.
Is a pepper steak just like peppercorn sauce on a steak?
I don't think so. I think it is sliced bell peppers, maybe.
What? Really?
Maybe we should like know what it is. Just to...
Oh wow! Look at that pepper steak. It's like Chinese stir fry kind of thing.
Yeah. That's what I thought.
Huh? That is not what I expected when he was describing the prison food.
Well. Can you imagine that being done poorly? I can.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Maybe they're talking about like a cheesesteak kind of sandwich.
But this isn't a cheesesteak.
Well, if you were to put that in like a hoagie or something, that would be like a combo, sort of like Italian beef style slash with peppers and things.
But it's just pepper steak if it's not in bread.
Hmm. What would you call it, a pepper steak sandwich?
I would.
Hmm.
I don't know. Judging by the fact that the default image search shows no bread in sight, I'm going to say that pepper steak is pepper steak and not a pepper steak sandwich.
All right. I'll allow it, Your Honor.
How does this trial work?
I don't know. You started it. You're the one who had to bring the law into
order.
It.
Order. Don't make order. Me call the bailiff.
I would like one pepper steak. Without a roll.
So
speaking of, I forgot to tell you we made Cubans tonight. It was pretty good.
Oh, you found a source for your pulled pork?
Yeah, I went to the grocery store that's about 10 miles away instead of our local one, and it is like three times the size of our grocery store, and it was magnificent. The selection was so gigantic. I may have actually said whoa, like when I walked into the deli section. I was just in awe of all of the options and selections they had. I got some freshly sliced salami and Swiss there, and I got to take samples, and they were delicious. Oh, it was so much fun. Anyway, the sandwich was good, but of course we had to use baguette, and it gets a little too crispy sometimes, and it's, you know, kind of hurts your mouth a little bit, but it's good.
Yeah, well, you used a baguette for the bread again this time.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. See, if you get Cuban bread, it
I looked. This was our best option.
Well, no, but I mean, I didn't mean that you just like neglected to pick it up. It is impossible for you to get outside of Florida, basically. But yeah, if you get real Cuban bread, it's more pliable, and so when you put it in the press, then it doesn't like become as the mouth gouging.
I was trying to remember that because I believe you said it does get a nice crisp to it, but it can't possibly be the same sort of like crouton exterior that you end up with a baguette.
No, because the crust on a Cuban bread is a loaf of Cuban bread is much softer because they make it with lard, as we have discussed before. Yeah.
Which makes me feel like I did in fact have Cuban bread when I was in Florida, because I distinctly remember the mouthfeel of the bread being different when I bit into that one there.
Well, that would be very possible. Although I don't know anything about the specific sandwich you had, but did you get the salami to do it Tampa style, or did you go South Florida style?
Oh, okay. you got to do the salami.
Yeah,
it's not the same without the salami.
Well, it's just one of those contentious things where it's like it's a Tampa edition because of all the Italian immigrants that were in Tampa that weren't in Miami at the time.
Well, yeah, it's I don't think it's a question. If there's an option to put salami on something, I always say yes.
I think you just did it because you like meat with more meat.
meat with extra meat?
Yeah.
No, I enjoy the salami. Mm-hmm. It's a good flavor, mixture with the pork. It goes well.
Mm-hmm. And it's a good sandwich. But one of these days, you're going to go have a Cuban sandwich in Tampa, Florida. Somehow.
Do you even have like a specific like restaurant to go to? Like, is it one of those things that there's like, just go to this place and just trust me, that's like the thing you need to get?
No, there's a few different places that you could go to. La Terracita would probably be one of the easier ones to get to, although you could try El Segundo, or if you're in St. Petersburg, as I am sometimes, there's a place called Bodega. But I usually get the pan con lechon, which is the one that's just the mojo pulled pork on the bread. Grilled.
You don't do the salami style.
Well, it's just a pulled pork sandwich. If you get that, pan con lechon.
Well,
bread with lechon. But
can you make can you make the appropriate roast pork for a Cuban sandwich in an Instant Pot?
No, no? It's going to be waterlogged. You could do it in a Dutch oven in your oven, but you're going to be there all day. So,
well, I am here all day, but we have an Instant Pot, and we were looking for things to cook with it.
If you're going to use an Instant Pot for Cuban food, then I would suggest Ropa Vieja, which I've done before, and that comes out great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You may have to give me that recipe or something.
Ropa Vieja is basically a Cuban pepper steak.
Son of a bitch. We pressure cook a wicked pepper steak.
Yeah.
Well.
Well,
looked better than the pepper steak that I just saw on Google when you did the thing.
Yeah. So you have a movie and things happen in the movie.
Yeah. You better think.
Yeah. Aretha has a good performance here, and she gets to be no nonsense and stuff about things.
And yet Matt Guitar Murphy says, I'm a man and you're a woman and I decide what happens in my life, and then throws down his apron and walks out, which is, you know, probably unwise, but it's what he does.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want to do that to Aretha Franklin.
He's probably playing at the end of this movie in prison going like, you know what? I could be cooking with Aretha Franklin right now, but I'm in jail instead.
Yeah. Well, they went to jail for a noble cause.
Yeah, they saved the orphanage and, you know, I mean, it's not Airhead, so they're not putting out a record like live in prison or whatever, but, you know, maybe they could have.
What I don't really understand is why they went to prison, I guess.
Oh, the rest of the band?
Yeah. What law did they break?
There's probably some sort of like conspiracy to commit fraud or something with the
accessory after the fact.
Yeah, maybe the fact that they took that $10,000 advance with really no intention to actually record a record. Who knows?
Possibly.
Yeah, or maybe on their way out of the theater after their performance, they'll beat up some fans or something.
They beat up the orphans.
They beat up the orphans. Yeah, they took the money back.
They started vandalizing all the orange whip bottles that were there. But
yes, we have to bring that up because you put that in the Slack, and I had no idea that that was the case.
Yeah, what Dan is referring to is a fact that I uncovered when I was Googling, because there's a funny moment that happens later in the movie where John Candy says he would like an orange whip, and would anybody else like an orange whip? And then orange whip, orange whip. Three orange whips, and it's just cute. It's a cute, fun little scene. I like it. It makes me laugh because it seems like such a frivolous beverage to order, and he does it with some seriousness. And there's not really any other dialogue in the scene, but the orange whip apparently is a carbonated juice beverage, not the orange whip cocktail, which
is disgusting. If you've ever looked it up,
I did. When I was looking this up, but apparently the only reason why orange whip was said was because one of the set designers had a relative that worked in for the beverage company and asked John Landis if orange whip could be said somewhere in the movie, and John Candy improvised this, and so that's the existence of it. It is product placement for someone's relative that they don't think they received any financial whatever for, so anyway, it's just in there.
And based on the fact that that drink is still very popular and in all of the stores, it has to have worked as a co-marketing thing.
Yes, absolutely. It is just the kind of thing where everybody goes to the Blues Brothers conventions and they're just ordering up orange whips left and right.
I mean, I would.
Is there a Blues Brothers convention, do you think? And how annoying do you think it would be to be there?
Well, the Wikipedia article described some sort of like theater showings in Australia where it's kind of like audience performance joining in. I imagine similar to Rocky Horror, except with less lingerie and stuff.
Mm-hmm. What if it was exactly the same amount of lingerie, but with Ray-Bans?
People are dressed up like Tim Curry, who's just wearing Wayfarer sunglasses.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
No, but
that brings some new context to give me some loving.
But this is one of those things where it's just I don't think I want to be around anybody who considers themselves to be someone that can cosplay convincingly as Belushi or as Aykroyd. I don't think I want to spend any time with
what
a
do you
human
think they
being.
Call themselves like blues heads, or you think they call themselves brothers, like Blues Brothers?
Probably, because I think they want to think that they're part of the band.
So or would they maybe be cousins, like Blues Cousins?
I don't know. Maybe maybe because they're looking for information on future sequels and trying to figure all that stuff out, that they would go by the name Blues Clues.
Anyway, once they get the band back together, they head over to Ray's Music Exchange in Calumet City and meet our friend Ray. Mm-hmm. And there's a performance, Ray Charles. He's there. He owns a record. He owns a music shop. And yeah. He's blind, but he shoots a gun at a small child who's trying to steal a guitar.
That was impressive.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, you know, of course, there are many great things about this scene, the performance being one of them. But I love that when Elwood comes in, he sees the little tiny toaster oven thing on the, like, the pawn shop counter and pulls a piece of bread out of his suit jacket pocket and places it in there to make sure that it fits.
Yeah. he has a really strange collection of things that he just has that he can pull out of anywhere.
Did you read that list of the deleted scenes that ended up in the longer version?
I did not. I didn't want to spoil the movie because I hadn't seen it yet when you were tweeting about the deleted scenes.
I'm very glad you didn't do that. But apparently there were scenes explaining how he had some sort of day job at like a chemical company that he steals a bunch of supplies from and then quits from to go be a priest at the end of the movie. But like all of the stuff, like the glue that he puts on the accelerator, all that stuff was stolen from there. And apparently there was another thing where he was going to put some gas in the cops' tires outside the performance so their tires would explode. And it's like, I'm really glad none of that crap was in here.
Yeah, you seemed particularly offended. Would you care to run through a list of changes? Or should probably save that for later.
Well, we'll save it for the end and or potentially the after show. But there's some weird junk they cut out, and I'm really glad they did. Anyway, they all shake their tail feathers, and there's people out on the street doing synchronized choreographed dances, which is hilarious. There's always that guy who makes that really disturbingly large smile when he's doing the bird. You know, did you see the guy I'm talking about?
Not really.
Yeah. Well, there's that guy. They do the monkey.
The mashed potato.
Mashed potato, yeah. Mm-hmm. All the good dances. Remember when there were dances?
Yeah. Yeah. But you don't have that anymore. Thanks, Taylor Swift.
Is she the one we blame for that?
She's a person that I just blamed for it, but it is probably not her.
This is where we plant our flag in the ground and start our campaign to take down Taylor Swift because she ruined our dances.
Or maybe we don't.
maybe we don't. Maybe we do. You don't know. We'll feel it out with like a change.org petition or something.
But see, the reboot we really need is Brandon Urie and Taylor Swift as the blueses. Are they
brother and sister, or are they a couple?
What do you think would be worse?
Brother and sister would be insufferable.
Let's do
it'd be like
that.
This generation's from Justin to Kelly. Wait, I don't even remember if they were siblings in that movie because I never saw that movie, but it was a thing.
That was the one with the people who won the thing.
American Idol. Kelly Clarkson and Justin, whatever the hell his name was.
Yeah, less famous person.
The guy who didn't really do anything afterward.
Sorry. What if he's a huge fan of our show? That would be weird. But
it'd be very weird.
Very weird. But
I would want to ask him if he still has that hair.
I mean, I feel like that's the kind of thing that you could find out through other means. But
why would I want to do that? I don't want to spoil it.
I'm gonna ruin the surprise. But they have collected people and instruments and stuff, and now they need a performance. So they go into a payphone, and the payphone is hit by the flamethrower, and then it blows
upwards.
The payphone's
suspiciously close to the gigantic propane tank.
And it blows upwards into the sky, and then falls back down again. And Carrie Fisher leaves, and they turn their nickel into probably $7 worth of quarters.
$7 a quarter, yeah. It's funny.
Yeah.
Did that look like a miniature to you, the way they shot it up in the air?
Sure.
And then the way it comes crashing down with clearly two, like, dummy fake bodies.
Oh, the fake bodies in this movie are not good. When they were driving through the stuff in the mall, and there's, like, there's supposed to be bodies hanging onto the car, but they're just so limp.
A lot of them are mannequins, too, that are, like, in the storefronts that they get smashed. But, yeah, that's sure.
Yeah,
did we miss that whole scene? Was that earlier?
Yes, that was.
Oh God, how did we miss the entire mall chase?
I don't know. You were in charge.
I was. I feel like that was under your tenure. I feel like that was under the previous administration.
Probably should have had somebody who knew about the movie talking about the movie is what I'm thinking.
Anyway, did you enjoy the mall chase scene?
It was interesting. I like the general mayhem. I didn't quite understand
the commentary on Pier 1 imports and new Oldsmobiles are in early this year.
Yeah, I didn't quite think it needed to go on as long as it did. But what do I know? The expert felt it did. And it did. But that sets them up in opposition with those cops, which is important.
Yes,
because
of course.
Now we are going to talk about the country club because they booked a venue. Which they didn't, and they're just gonna.
By which we mean they drove around for 3 hours until they finally came across. And they're like, "Yeah, we'll just play here and pretend."
Yes, and this does not go super well because This is, but there is one amazing line in here when they talk to the waitress, the bartender, and ask, you know, what kind of music people listen to in here. And she says, we got both kinds, country and Western. And I chuckled at that. That was a good line.
I also love during that interaction that Belushi's attempt at sounding more country is to just yell everything that he says. Just like, yeah, we're the band, and just being as obnoxious as he possibly can with a very loud voice, because apparently that's how you sell being a country musician.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if that was just because he was nervous about getting called on it or something.
I feel like he was trying to do his country lead singer affectation there.
Yeah, and they were all very surprised by setting up on the stage, which had a country chicken wire. And
I love, Bob's like, oh, you probably want to go get your steel guitars and stuff set up there. And I'm just like, eh, we don't have steel guitars. Okay, whatever. Sure, Bob, and your country bunker.
And then that was a country bucket.
Bunker? Bob's country bunker. Bob's country bucket would be a good name for a bar, though.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a bunker, though. It was just a mostly
a bucket
flat,
either.
Like, building. Anyway, so...
It's a honky tonk, according to Wikipedia, a local honky tonk.
Mm. So they get up there and they do a song, and it is not to the taste of the audience, which materialized out of thin air. They start throwing stuff and heckling, and so they realize they got to switch gears, but they don't really know anything. So they do Rawhide, the theme Rawhide, and then they pivot from that into the other country song thing.
Stand By Your Man.
Yeah.
Yeah. And what I don't know about you, but I like to imagine in my mind that they played those two songs on repeat for the entire evening.
Hmm. Well, it went on as long as it needed to for me. But they
closed their set with Rawhide as well, at least.
Yeah. And then everything finishes up and the people who were there disappear, and they're just talking to Bob again, and it's about their beer bill. That they've rung up from their performance, I guess.
Yeah, so. they drank $300 worth of beer, and their pay for the night was supposed to be $200, which is pretty terrible. Although I guess when expensive soup is $10, $200 ain't that bad.
I guess. But let's just think about the cost of labor. Like how could you possibly drink enough beer to eclipse that performance?
Well, I mean, maybe they were thirsty. I was, let me see here. Let's see, $200 and $1980, it's almost $600. That's not bad.
So, how much is $300?
Oh, how much is $300? It was gonna be like $900 or something, isn't it?
How does this, I couldn't.
You couldn't drink $900 worth of beer if you tried?
Is it possible?
$892, yeah. So, solid beer.
Yeah, it's insane. But, so anyway, Bob wants to collect, and they say, sure, we'll just go get it from the car. They go outside, and then they meet the good old boys who show up in a truck that has one of those, like, camper things on the back.
It's a Winnebago.
Whatever. The thing that they flip over is the truck with the thing on top, though, right?
The camper, when all of the guys are laying in the top little section, peering out of the little tiny window.
Mm-hmm. It explodes, but somehow there are no bodies from that. But they like have a weird thing with like facing off with a union. You got your union card, and it's like, why are you even talking to these guys? Just leave.
He pulls a switcheroo. He makes them think to like wait by the Winnebago while they go talk to Bob, and they tell Bob that they're going to write out a American Express traveler's check on the dash of the car, and then they speed away, and then leave them both hanging, and they're mad. And they chase after him.
And the cop car from earlier spots their Dodge, and they go to pursue, and they floor it just in time to smack into the truck with the camper. And they both flip and explode. And then,
did you love how seamless the effect was there?
So seamless, especially when the geyser of water starts coming out of the camper toilet, I guess. I'm not sure what that was supposed to really signal.
I just like how they're both like 10 feet apart when whatever sort of gas strut underneath fired to make them both flip, and they just both do a nice rotation perfectly in sync.
Yeah, it's not great. But they're in a lot of trouble. Not that much trouble, apparently, because they're in the rest of the movie. So
it was enough trouble that the police officers are pointing weapons at them.
Yeah, but not enough for like jail time or anything. But that's the end of that. And then they are going to go book another location, but they gotta figure out what to do. So they go talk to the guy that they were gonna call earlier. Mm-hmm. Morty? What's his name? Morty? I want to say Morty.
Sline?
Sure. And they do that in the sauna, and you're cutting back and forth between him and them. He mentions...
Maury. It is Maury.
Yeah, I had a feeling. And because he is upset about their Fakakta plan or whatever, which is
he said
fun.
Fakakta suits, but yeah, their plan is idiotic because he says, you know, book us in this massive 5,000-seat concert hall for tomorrow night, because apparently at this point in the movie they've used 10 of their 11 days somehow, although it didn't seem like it. But yeah, they've got one more day, so they've got to rally and get that big gig so they can make enough money to save the orphanage.
Yep. And Belushi blackmails him about something about his wife knowing about something.
Earlier in the movie, he said he owes his favor. He got him late or something. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But they picked the Palace Hotel ballroom up north because it seats 5,000 people. And $2 cover, so not
free
bad.
Parking.
Free parking. Yes, they steal a giant loudspeaker from a child's park, which looked like maybe like a bomb siren or something, or an air raid siren, which was very unusual to be there. Hopefully nobody was hurt as a result of not being able to be warned by an earthquake or something.
Yes, this frequently happens in Chicago.
I don't know.
But they are driving around alerting everybody, and Kemp Calloway gets all the orphans to alert everybody, and they're handing out flyers and stuff.
When you say it like that, Cab Calloway gets all the orphans to pass out flyers. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, Ray hangs one upside down. Aretha hangs one up in her window because it's very important.
Yeah, and
somebody draws one on the bathroom wall that the good old boys see.
And basically everybody becomes aware of this, so they're all the foes are rendezvousing in a manner at this the Palace Hotel to keep an eye on the situation and get the Blues Brothers at the end of it.
Mm-hmm. All the good old boys bring their axe handles.
But the Blues Brothers, in all of their questing, ran out of gas, and so they got to wait for gas, and the gas station attendant guy is out of gas because the truck's late. It's always late on Thursdays. And so they're waiting there, and then we get a terrible scene of Dan Aykroyd hitting on a woman, which is the only thing that Dan Aykroyd seems to know how to write, awkward things between him and other women.
The whole movie isn't an awkward scene with him hitting on a woman.
No, but it always seems to turn up in things. So he's hitting on Twiggy, the British model. I believe she is credited as the first supermodel. She has a small role in this.
Is that so?
Yeah, she has a small role in this where she's, you know, late to an engagement thing that she's got to do, and she's getting gas, and he pulls a fast one on her with, oh, that's going to be $94, and she's like, oh, well, here's 95, and she hands 100, and then he's like, okay, well, I only got a dollar change, and she's like, well, then keep it, I guess, or whatever. So he cons her out of $100, which is nice. For basically doing nothing. And then they finally fill up the car and leave to go rendezvous. But because they're so late, Curtis, Cab Calloway, has to go on stage and sing an opening number to appease the crowd.
Yeah, you don't want them to riot. They're all right there. You had your opportunity to save the orphanage, and they're late.
Yeah.
Oh, no. Are they going to make it?
And so he performs, and when he does, like as you said earlier, magically the stage transforms, the instruments transform, their clothing and wardrobe and hair and everything transforms into this white, jazz lounge, blues lounge kind of a thing.
Like big band look where they've all got those little like stands right in front of them with the big BB logo.
Mm-hmm. And so he's singing up a storm. and knocking him dead because he's Cab Calloway and he can do that. As opposed to later scenes where Dan Aykroyd and Belushi are singing, and it's just not as good. They should have just had Curtis do the whole thing. But
it's not really the Curtis movie. It's the Blues Brothers movie.
I would have rather watched the Curtis movie. But they have them arrive, and they park under a bridge where all the troopers are waiting above. They sneak over to the Winnebago, glue the pedal with the marine epoxy, and Dan Aykroyd explains to Belushi that it's glue.
Did you like the way they were sneaking along to the beat of the music?
It was okay. But then they had
Family Guy parodied that. Did you ever see that?
No. It's hard to believe that Family Guy would parody something from a movie.
Yeah. It's a popular scene.
Mm. But then they break the glass with punching the hat thing, and then they're in the women's restroom, and excuse us, blah, 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 they're in. And they get up on stage, and they do a thing, and then another thing, and everybody seems very entertained, and then they sneak out.
Yes, they sing two songs. And then they wander off stage. There is a apparently the owner of Clarion Records who wants to do an album with them and happened to have $10,000 in cash in his jacket pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So he gives that to them as an advance on their recording album. He says, give some of this money back to Ray because they owe money for all of the instruments. And they take their $5,000 and they sneak through a hatch behind the drummer to make their getaway.
Yes, and that leads to the sewage service tunnel thing where Carrie Fisher is waiting for them with an
M16 rifle.
Yeah, and she fires everywhere except for them, and they lay flat on the ground, and she's spraying them with bullets, and it's hitting all around them, but not them. And then she finally uses dialogue to say something to Belushi about how she was spurned. She was deserted at the altar. And it doesn't seem something that Belushi was really thinking about or concerned with up until this point.
It makes up a lot of excuses. Tux didn't come back, ran out of gas. I don't even remember how many there were. The list goes on. It was all very
stupid.
Friend
was in town. It was a bunch of stuff that couldn't have possibly happened all at the same time.
It was not his fault. And this is also the first time in the movie where we see his or Aykroyd's eyes, because he takes off his glasses to use the full extent of his charm with his eyes.
Yes, and she is wooed by this temporarily so that he could push her on the ground.
And he gives her a kiss and then drops her in the mud.
Yeah,
and then she quickly awakes from her. Starry-eyed love, and then chases after him with the rifle, and her along with the police shoot at the car as they drive away.
Yeah, you think they would have like taken her rifle or kicked it or put it somewhere else, but they're just like, yeah, let's run away from her with a rifle.
I mean, they're all on the same side for the moment, but yeah, maybe after that they had a chat with her.
And so they peel off in their car, and then we have the nighttime on the road thing, and all the police cars are chasing. John Candy is in the police car.
They're chasing them at night, and this is another one where it fades to black and then fades up, and it's daytime, and Belushi is sleeping in the passenger seat, and they're still going like 120 miles an hour down the freeway, and nobody has apparently been able to call ahead a roadblock or anything that would have been useful in stopping this, so it's just like 40 cop cars behind the Blues Brothers speeding down the highway towards Chicago.
Yeah, and then Dan Aykroyd decides to get off the road, and all the police cars get off the road, but they do it poorly, and then everything explodes, and they all drive into each other, and they flip and stuff, and then John Candy's police car is launched into the air and hits a truck.
Yeah, where's a truck?
Yeah.
You didn't like any of that?
It was just gratuitously goofy.
Yeah, slapstick, gratuitous car crashes.
Anyway, so they're almost to Chicago, and there's the big blockade thing, and then they blow through that.
Don't forget the good old boys. Their accelerator got stuck, and they go.
Oh yeah.
They somehow very quickly found like a port or something, and they go flying through into a lake or something.
Yes, they go through a boathouse into the water.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the end of them. And one guy turns to the other guy and says, don't say anything, or don't say a bleeping word or something. And they have the car chase continue, and now the Nazis are after them, and the police cars, and they're all just smashing into each other all over the place, left and right. And then there's the freeway thing with the closed freeway, and then they flip. And then the Nazi car is like dropped from an incredibly high helicopter altitude, and then crashes through asphalt and makes a cartoon car shaped rectangle divot in the ground where the other Nazi car drives directly into it.
And they jump over it by just hitting the gas harder.
Yeah. And there's more police stuff and chasing, and there's a part where Dan Aykroyd just launches the car by not doing anything. There's no ramp or anything, and they jump over the police cars. It's unclear how that happened.
Yeah, apparently that was also one of the things that was cut out of the movie. Apparently when he pulled in that little narrow alleyway next to his apartment, he like hooked it up to a like large electrical box that was supposed to somehow insinuate that's how the car got its like supernatural abilities, but that's incredibly stupid, so I prefer to just believe that it's silly for the sake of being silly.
Sure. It's as good an explanation as any, is that it's silly.
They wanted to smash some cars. Like, they smash all these cars, and then, like, all of the cops are angry. Not so much at, like, the law breaking, but just all of the car accidents. So they all just start, like, indiscriminately shooting in the direction that the Blues Brothers drove off. Like, that's an advisable thing to do. But anyways.
Yeah, I hope all these stunt people are okay. I didn't read about any major incidents, but...
Yeah. I believe it said... the cars were like $400, all the police cars that they bought, which is kind of amazing to think that you could buy a used police car for $400 back then.
Yeah. I mean, how many used police cars could you have if you really thought about it?
Like right now?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I probably only got room for one right now.
Mm. You should totally do that, though.
I should buy a used police car.
Yeah, just get one of those old police interceptors that was, you know, basically a Lincoln Town Car / Grand Marquis, and you floor it. That thing's probably got a cubic 40 whatever thing in it.
Well, it depends on which generation you go for. Do you go for the one that was the year before the catalytic converter, so it runs good on regular gas, which is a line that's in this movie for some reason. They did the Lincoln Town Cars, and then for a little while they had... Chevy Impalas here, those kind of square looking ones, and then they moved on to they're mostly SUVs now, like Tahoes.
Oh, I was gonna say it's mostly Explorers over here.
Oh yeah, actually the Tahoes was a brief period, but yeah, they're on like the Explorers, like those Ford Edge things now.
Yeah, and I think it's mostly Ford Explorers and the occasional Dodge Charger.
Yeah, there's some Chargers.
Yeah, is that the one I'm thinking of? It's not the Challenger. Yep. The Challenger is right. The one that's the bloated Camaro thing.
The more retro-y looking one.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Bloated Camaro. But the chase keeps going and going and going, and then they get to the building that they need to. They go inside. They barricade the door.
Don't forget that the car finally retires and explodes into 100 different pieces.
Apparently it was a specially rigged thing where it would fall apart like that. Which I think took them weeks or something in order to set it up to fall apart just the right way.
Mm-hmm. They have a nice moment of silence.
It falls apart just the right way. And then you get a reaction shot from the statues, that are in the building, on the building. But they get inside, barricade themselves in there, and then, go ask the lobby security guards who, think nothing suspicious is happening and direct them to the assessor's office. They go down the other hallway to a single elevator, not the bank of elevators, and then they take that single elevator up. They sabotage the elevator, barricade the stairs with something that doesn't seem like it could possibly barricade the stairs door.
Two chairs, two ashtrays, and then a bench on top of the ashtrays.
When they shoot that thing up in order to open it, it's just like, yeah, sure, whatever. The physics of this, it doesn't make any sense.
Well, don't forget the guy on the radio said the use of excessive force and violence against the Blues Brothers has been approved. Yeah. So at least they got the go-ahead to use excessive violence.
Yeah, take that, ashtrays. But they get inside the office. They barricade the office with a desk. Then they go to
the doors are glass and there's glass windows next to it.
Yeah, it seems incredibly futile. But then they go back to the office, and there's a be back in 5 minutes thing hanging on the door. And then some guy comes up half eating a sandwich.
Steven Spielberg.
Yeah. And then they break in and wait, that was Steven Spielberg?
That was the Steven Spielberg cameo.
Oh, I guess I don't recognize him without his hat.
Yeah, yeah, without his hat. He had long hair and glasses. And then, you know, yeah, he's eating a sandwich and they grab him and say, here's the cash for the orphanage. And then he just kind of stares at it. And then he writes up a receipt and stamps it. And you got all of the fun cutting back and forth between the writing out of the receipt and the handing over the money and the stamping. And right as they reach for the receipt, they slap handcuffs on him. And you turn around and there are the entire army is there pointing machine guns right in their face, which seems unwise. Yeah. To be that close to your enemy, but whatever, it's fine. They've overwhelmed them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, this is not a movie about, you know, tactics. It's a movie about slapstick comedy. But they are in jail and they perform, and then the credits roll.
Jailhouse Rock, man. Yeah. And then they do the thing that can be done well and done poorly in movies, where other people from the movie are singing the song that goes over the credits, but it's all of the good singers throughout the movie. It's not just a bunch of random ass weirdos singing along, like, was that Be Cool that we just saw where they did that?
Yeah, because it was like cut from other whatever things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, and then that's it. You get your credits. Mm-hmm. Those Blues Brothers.
Yep.
It's a fun movie full of fun music. It's a blues musical.
Yeah.
I still sense some hesitance from you.
I don't know. Maybe I'd like it more if I had saw it when I was younger.
Do you regret seeing this movie?
No. Because now I don't have to worry about ever being in a social situation where somebody makes a Blues Brothers reference and I don't understand it or have to say that I haven't seen it. Mm. I'm looking at you, Rye Amadon.
Now you just have to, you will recognize the reference. But you'll probably sigh disapprovingly, and then you'll get an equal but different amount of criticism from people.
But what if I don't sigh disapprovingly? What if I just fake it because I care about their opinion of me?
And you go, oh, yeah, that part. I remember that. That's when that other thing happened. That was fun.
Mm-hmm. And then if it's something that I don't remember because I wasn't paying attention, then I can always just go, oh, yeah, you know, it's just been a long time since I've seen it. But, yeah, sure, that classic line.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Classic line.
Classic line. Orange whip.
You're gonna look pretty funny eating corn on the cob without any teeth, which is a really weird line.
Mm-hmm.
But he sells it so hard.
Yeah.
I also like Donald Duck Dunn. It's a pretty great nickname if you had to pick one.
I mean, too many D's for me.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. Three.
Yeah, three D's is too much D.
I mean, technically there are four in his name, but...
Well, he's 4D.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you ever think Guy Fieri's going to retire his show and then do something with 4Ds in it?
Hmm.
Maybe it can just be a clip show of all of his other clip shows that he's running these days.
Cooks, clips, captions, and...
Those are C's.
Yeah, I know.
Four C's.
He's got triple D and he's got triple G, so it doesn't necessarily have to be quadruple D.
Okay.
Hmm.
Fine. Ruin it for me.
I mean, quadruple has a few too many syllables.
Mm-hmm. But what if you replace all the syllables with D's? No, it wasn't supposed to make any sense, Dan. But yeah, that finishes the movie. Are there any other classic lines that you want to recite before the end of this so that you don't regret it later and are just like, oh man, I should have said this or what about that?
No, just all of it, the whole movie.
Mm-hmm. And then, as you had mentioned, some of the egregious changes. Were there any other egregious changes that you haven't brought up yet?
Oh God, this list is really, like, I mean, it starts off innocuously enough. It's very stupid. Like, there's a scene where the guards try to wake Jake up from his cell and, like, poke him for a little while. Frank Oz has one additional line about Belushi's possessions. It's like, okay, I can see why that got cut. It doesn't make a difference. A lot of the music numbers are longer. Demolition Derby in the mall here. Oh, yeah, yeah. So after the Demolition Derby, the shopping mall, He parks the Bluesmobile in a hiding place beside an electrical box. John Landis explains that Aykroyd thought this would show how the car gets its incredible endurance, but also goes on to explain that it never made any sense, so the scene was cut. So at least John Landis has some sort of understanding of when stuff doesn't make sense. He just doesn't care in some instances, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, it's a powerful ability to be able to say to Dan Aykroyd, no, your scene is dumb.
Yeah.
It's something that people said less and less to him over the years after his success in films.
I am really just nauseous at the idea that we're going to have to watch the sequel of this movie.
Well, we don't have to because it's not free. So if
it's certainly not worth money, I can tell you that much.
But I just thought about, you know, making you do it for like punishment reasons. But I don't really care. We can do something fun instead.
Okay, that would be nice. I liked this movie.
That's good. I'm glad you
like
it.
I feel like you, such a backhanded way of saying you don't care about it. But
here's the thing. I'm not angry that I saw this or anything. I'm not upset with you. I'm not upset with the world. I have completed a task. It is done.
You have completed a task of watching a John Landis movie. Can we at least say this is one of the least bad John Landis movies?
Of the ones that I've seen, yes, I believe that would be the qualification I would agree to.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Okay.
It pleases the court.
It pleases the court that this isn't Animal House. Well, you got Trading Places there. Trading Places probably had some more weirdness to it.
Oh, Trading Places was real awkward. This is not as bad in those reasons. It's just not fantastic, but whatever.
But you're going to download the soundtrack. You're gonna watch it frequently on television. You're going to quote lines to your friends.
If I say yes, are you going to let the podcast end?
Maybe.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I'm glad you didn't hate watching it.
I'm glad I didn't hate watching it, too.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, while I was kidding earlier about, like, you know, maybe I wouldn't enjoy this or something, or have some criticism or whatever, it was... you know, not a situation where I felt like I needed to, like, take this movie to task. So, it's fine. Everybody came out on top.
I'm still just struggling to figure out where this fits in the Joe opinion chain. Because there's rarely a movie where you don't have strong feelings. It's usually one direction or the other.
Well, we usually... if we're picking something to watch, it's usually something that I have a strong opinion about already, because usually it's something that I've seen before. If it's something I haven't seen before, then we do have the occasional situation where I run into something at the end and I'm just like, not for me, but it's okay. Which is something I try to avoid. Sometimes people will shout out movie suggestions and I'll be like, yeah, it was okay. Like if it's something I had seen, but not something I want to do for the podcast. Or conversely, sometimes there are really great movies that I just don't feel like make good conversations. So I don't select those either. But this is a situation where going into it sight unseen, I had no preconception about it other than it was going to be a little sloppy-ish, and it was, but no more so than other stuff, you know. So there you go.
5 stars.
On what scale?
Whatever you want.
Mm. Sure. Okay, well, I'll disclose that number later. All right. And that's all, folks. Enjoy your 5-star on an anonymous scale movie.
That's all, folks. That was not Donald Duck.
No.
I guess that's as good a place to end as any.
Yeah, because I said that's all, folks. So I feel like that's an ending.
Sure.
If anything is an ending.
if anything ever really ends. Come on, baby.
same old.